Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bown. I have a new website. It is simonbown.com. That's Bown, not Brown. It replaces the Past Lives Hypnosis website, and you can go to the new website, the Past Life Regression, as well as my books and podcasts. This week, I'm talking to Jesse Baring about his book, The Incredible Afterlives of Dr. Stevenson, one scientist's epic quest for evidence of reincarnation, apparitions, poltergeists, and other matters of the soul. Jesse is director of the Centre for Science Communication at the University of Otago in New Zealand. His writings have been translated into many different languages and reviewed in the New York Times, The Guardian, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and many other outlets. Hi, Jesse. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Simon.
We're going to talk about your book. It's called The Incredible Afterlives of Dr. Stevenson. And this is about Ian Stevenson, the researcher. So can you tell us, why did you write this book? What interests you about Dr. Stevenson?
Well, he's long fascinated me. I first wrote an article about Ian Stevenson's research back in 2013, I believe, in a column in Scientific American. And I was basically, acknowledging that I found his research as a meticulous investigator studying paranormal phenomena to be quite challenging for me as a skeptic who studied people's beliefs about the afterlife.
And he had a background in psychiatry, didn't he?
Right. So Ian Stevenson was this, famed figure in the history of parapsychology. His foray, I suppose, into parapsychological science or paranormal research didn't really begin in earnest until he was in his 40s. And before that, he had a very reputable mainstream career in science as a psychiatrist, as a researcher in the field of psychosomatic medicine in particular. And ultimately, he became the head of the neurology and psychiatry department at the University of Virginia, which is part of the medical school there, and began to go increasingly in this direction of parapsychological research. But again, yes, before that, he was a pioneering figure in psychiatry, psychosomatic medicine. He did research on forensic interviewing techniques of patients in the examining room, and was quite a respectable figure independently of his paranormal studies.
And so did he have an interest in this kind of thing when he was younger, like 10, 15 years old or his 20s? Was he interested in anything supernatural?
Even before that. I mean, he said that he had a lifelong interest in the question of the afterlife, and actually, I think, kind of said tongue-in-cheek that that might have related in itself to a past life obsession that he carried over into this life. But he was exposed to the ideas of karma and reincarnation and related topics through his mother, who was into, I suppose, what we would call now New Age philosophies. She was an adherent of the Theosophical movement at that time, which Ian Stevenson referred to as a sort of potted Buddhism for Westerners. And she had an extensive eclectic library filled with books on reincarnation and topics like medicinal herbs and spirituality. So he was steeped in this from a very early age. However, I should say that his father was quite antagonistic to his mother's beliefs and was what he considered to be more of a sort of materialist rationalist who thought that what his wife was up to was just complete woo and really frowned upon that. So I think, you know, I didn't want to psychoanalyze Ian Stevenson, but I think there was a domestic tension between his mother and his father's belief systems that probably played some role in his interest as well.
So just to get a perspective, what years are we talking about? Because he was doing a lot of research in the 60s, wasn't he? But when was he born?
So he was born in 1918 on Halloween in Canada. And he died in 2007 at the age of 88. And again, most of his conventional sort of mainstream research in psychiatry and psychosomatic medicine happened, you know, in the 1940s, 50s. And then going increasingly into the 60s, that's when he really leaned into his passion for studying the question of whether consciousness survives death.
And he's well known for his research into children's past life memories.
Yeah, he's the guy. He's the guy that basically began that line of investigation.
But he did so much other investigative stuff that's not about that. And I didn't know how much he'd done. I wanted to ask you about, he was doing experiments with mescaline.
Right. So I got the sense that he didn't like to talk about this that much, because I think that if others knew that his research was influenced or inspired by his experiences with mescaline and LSD and other psychedelics, they would somehow view his work on children's memories of past lives less seriously. But yes, he was really a pioneer in psychedelic research before Timothy Leary. He was doing controlled studies in his laboratory with mescaline and LSD. He was inspired by Aldous Huxley's book, Doors of Perception. And the idea, at least, you know, as part of his psychiatric research, was to simulate the state of psychosis that you would see in a schizophrenic patient. So he called this experimental psychosis, and he wanted to somehow probe the minds of those that were in these states while they were on, I know hallucinogenic is a loaded term, but psychedelics at least, and find out what their phenomenological experiences were like in that state, sort of interviewed them while they were tripping. And he also experimented with these drugs himself during this period. And I think as a product of that, he really sort of opened up his mind, so to speak, about these questions about consciousness, and especially consciousness surviving death. He allegedly had a memory of a past life while he was on LSD, but he didn't share the details of what it was.
Because he said that he thought mescaline might reduce the filtration powers of the brain. It's kind of suggesting that there's so much more going on around us and the brain filters it all out. And if you have the mescaline, then you're open to so much more.
Right. So he was channeling, no pun intended, the ideas of William James and C.D. Broad and others, especially during the, you know, the early psychical research movement in the late 1800s, about the brain essentially being a transmission device rather than an organ that generates consciousness from within. So he thought that somehow these drugs, right, expanded our subjective conscious awareness of everything that's happening outside what our normal perceptual capacities would be. So he thought it was I remember he described it as basically, you know, not hallucinating, but sort of putting on your glasses to see more clearly under the influence of these drugs.
So where do you stand on all this stuff about consciousness surviving death? Are you on the fence? Are you quite skeptical?
I'm skeptical, just like Ian Stevenson was skeptical. I think, you know, both of us were continually interrogating our own intuitions and our own beliefs and how we came to help to hold them. I began this book, you know, with a very different objective in mind. I'm a traditional psychological scientist. I study social cognition. For decades, I've been researching how people think about the mind after death, not so much whether the mind actually survives death, but just simply from a psychological perspective, how do we reason about, how do we attribute mental states to the dead? And my takeaway from all of those studies, you know, that I've done over the years is basically that that the afterlife is a cognitive illusion, that this is a sort of artifact of our evolved theory of mind, our attributing mental states in places where they don't properly belong. But then I had to sort of take a pause when I really got into the weeds of Ian Stevenson's studies, because I realized that I couldn't just simply explain away many of the cases that he was reporting through the lens of contemporary psychological science and the traditional lines of cognitive biases and so on. So I found myself kind of between a rock and a hard place with this book. I went into it as a skeptic. I still am a skeptic, but the needle has moved a little bit for me after really immersing myself in Ian Stevenson's body of work.
Yeah, I find that sometimes, or a lot of time, people who are very materialist, when they really look into this stuff, they find that they can't completely just rule it out and say it's all nonsense. It's like you look at it and think, oh, hang on a second, there might be something here.
So that's the trick, is just getting yourself to engage with the literature. You know, so many skeptics, so many materialists just simply won't even look at it. And that, you know, that was a source of constant frustration and consternation for Ian Stevenson. So I hope I did him at least that justice, at least, you know, engaging seriously with his work.
How did he get interested in children's, like, past life memories? Was it some kind of accidental thing he stumbled over? Or?
So he entered a competition in 1959 that was sponsored by the American Society for Psychical Research, and there was an essay competition, and the prize was basically for the most compelling evidence or case that could be made for the survival of consciousness after death. And it was the essay prize was in honor of William James. And Ian Stevenson by that time was the head of the psychiatry and neurology department at UVA, but was increasingly sort of dabbling in these parapsychological topics. And I don't know exactly how he put the pieces together, but I think, you know, partially it was because of his longstanding interest in reincarnation, you know, his exposure to the subject matter through his mother, but also, you know, in the intervening years, all the documentation that he'd read about cases that he thought were intriguing, that were reported in newspapers and books about reincarnation. And he basically compiled an essay that analyzed data that had been published in these public sources over decades that suggested that the most convincing cases were those of, he saw a pattern, basically. The pattern suggested that the cases that were most convincing were of very young children who began speaking spontaneously about idiosyncratic details of their previous lives that could be authenticated independently to match the details of somebody who actually lived before they were born. He thought there was something to that. But that, at that time, it was just secondhand accounts. These weren't his actual cases. He was just summarizing what was already publicly available. But he thought something was standing out from that analysis. And that essay won the prize. It was a $300 award for the essay. And I think that motivated him. It's probably a lot more money in 1960 than it is now. And he was ultimately that essay got a lot of attention, and it ultimately caught the attention of a researcher that was in India that had noticed a similar trend of these children talking about previous lives in India, and the desperate need, he said, for serious researchers to begin studying these cases. And he convinced Dean Stevenson to travel to India in 1961, I believe, was the first time that he went out there.
Was that Dr. Banerjee? Was he kind of warned about working with that doctor?
Right. So Banerjee was a colorful character, an Indian parapsychologist who was very charismatic and convincing and persuasive in terms of encouraging Ian Stevenson to work with him at the travel all the way out there. But there were some red flags early on. Banerjee was not terribly well informed about scientific methodology, wasn't very well versed in the parapsychology literature, and ultimately it was revealed that he was lying about actually having a PhD. But his role at that point was mostly just to serve as a translator on these cases in India, not to be a co-investigator per se.
Was he taking articles from other people's work and then republishing it in his own magazine or something?
That was an allegation by Irene Garrett, who was the head of the Parapsychological Association, and who also is the one, she's the famous skeptical medium, as they referred to her. She had a brilliant history as a medium in the sort of early 20th century into the middle of the 20th century. And she was the founder of the Parapsychological Association, and they had a magazine and newsletters and those types of things. And apparently Banerjee was stealing some of their content and republishing it in the Indian language in his magazines. So yeah, there was some worry there that he wasn't entirely an honest character.
So how was Ian Stevenson's first trip to India? Was it successful?
Stressful, as he said. You know, he said that if he had known more about India and how difficult it would have been to travel at that time throughout the subcontinent, that he probably would have had serious second thoughts about going. But in the end, he gathered together what he considered to be these sort of earth-shattering findings about these young children, and many of them, you know, 3-4 years of age, that were relaying detailed information about somebody, oftentimes from a completely separate village that had died years before, that through his interrogation of witnesses and conversations with family members and so on, all lined up. And it to him was, you know, this was a major revelation in terms of finding significant evidence for the existence of some sort of afterlife that involved reincarnation.
And was there a kind of a problem where perhaps he was coming into the cases too late, and that the child had met the previous family they claimed to be part of, and there'd been all this communication and confirmation, and Ian Stevenson hadn't been a part of that?
Right. So the major flaw with most of his cases, I should say, is as pointed out by critics, is that by the time he arrived on the scene, the child at the heart of the case was oftentimes, you know, an adult by this point. It had been decades since their spontaneous utterances of a previous life. And he could only rely on what the parents said happened and interviews with other friends and family members and people from the unrelated family about the directionality and the timing of different bits of information. And he was very much cognizant of that problem and the limitations of the findings. But I guess what allowed me to put a little bit more credence into the cases was the fact that he was a seasoned psychiatric interviewer, and he was exquisitely trained to recognize signs of deception and forgetting and confabulation, fabrication, and outright fraud. And he was also aware of his own biases in terms of his interpretation of the cases. He was constantly second-guessing himself in terms of whether he could trust his own instincts. So the totality, I suppose, of the cases was quite strong in terms of the evidentiary value. They definitely weren't flawless. He never claimed to have a case throughout his entire career, including that initial trip to India in which it offered proof of reincarnation. There was always some weakness inherent to the case.
So would you say then he was quite skeptical and meticulous with his research?
He was definitely meticulous. I mean, this is one of the reasons I think that so few people have actually indulged in his writings, because they are dense, they are very academic, almost, you know, in the form of medical treaties in terms of the granular details. And they don't make for a very engaging read, despite the subject matter, which is about the afterlife and reincarnation, because they are so particular. So he was certainly methodical. There's no question about that. Very rigorous. His entire approach to these cases was what I would call sort of an offense rather than defense, or preemptive. He was trying to constantly anticipate what the critics or the skeptics would say and eliminate more parsimonious explanations, so that all that was essentially remaining was this framework of reincarnation. But again, he never claimed to provide proof. He always used that, his hallmark phrase, which was suggestive of reincarnation.
But he did see children before the, say, previous family was found. So he was able to do that sort of research.
There were a handful of cases where he did arrive on the scene, so to speak, while the child was still very young and was still talking about the previous life, and before they had actually met and communicated with the other family, or the family of the so-called previous personality. And he would, in those cases, he interviewed the child. He made extensive notes about the items of information that they were giving, and only then traveled with the child to these other villages or these remote places, and was able to authenticate that somebody with that name, with those details, actually did live. It was never 100% accuracy, but some were quite high in terms of the amount of information that they were able to give. I mean, we're talking, you know, first names, last names, the layout of a house, what they were growing in the garden, where things were hidden in the closet, things along those lines.
And there was, there's a sentence in your book that says it was unlikely entire families and communities lied and acted in flawless collusion to deceive him.
Right. So, I mean, sort of an extreme skeptical approach would be to say that, you know, somehow there was this conspiracy of deception where many parties were involved. I mean, his average cases had upwards of 20, 25 witnesses that he interviewed. And the evidence would converge in a particular direction. And to say that this was deception or fraud really requires some serious lifting.
Yeah, I suppose, especially if it happens with like hundreds of cases.
Yes, and also he pointed out that in many of these communities and these cultural contexts in which he studied reincarnation, the families don't necessarily want to know that their child was the reincarnation of a particular individual. Oftentimes this caused more problems in their families and their social lives and it didn't offer any particular rewards. So there was an incentive, if anything, to not share this information publicly.
So how does Chester Carlson fit in?
So Chester Carlson was a eccentric sort of physicist inventor type, and he's best known for inventing the Xerox photocopying process. And he also just simply happened to have a strong interest in parapsychology and paranormal phenomena, but wanted it to be studied from a scientific perspective. He wasn't convinced, I guess, by the sort of sensationalist mainstream accounts that were coming out. He thought that parapsychology deserved its own place at the table as a rigorous academic discipline. So he was, he was already funding J.B. Rhine and the group at Duke University when he first heard about Ian Stevenson, and became increasingly convinced that Ian Stevenson was, really the person to invest in terms of giving significant amounts of money for research in the field.
Because he was a very rich man, wasn't he?
Right. Chester Carlson grew up in abject poverty. He was literally sleeping in a chicken coop in high school with his tuberculosis-ridden father. His mother died when he was 17. Had a really just difficult, challenging, poverty-stricken life, but was a brilliant physicist and inventor, and had been plugging away at this completely original, innovative photocopying technology for decades before he ultimately sold the patent to a small company called the Haploid Foundation, and he ultimately became what would be a billionaire overnight, essentially, by the time he was about 50 years old. And then he had all the money in the world, and his only, endeavor was to give it all away before he died. He was a true humanitarian.
I wanted to get on to an aspect of his research, which is to do with birthmarks or birth defects that the child has that seem to relate very well to the previous life.
Stevenson had a collection of cases of children's memories of previous lives that he thought was especially valuable. And these are what he called biological cases, essentially, where the child was not only remembering details of the previous life, but they also had physical marks, such as, birthmarks or even birth defects that typically matched the bodily form and oftentimes the fatal wounds of the previous personality that they said that they were remembering. So his major tome, I guess, is this enormous 2-volume book that I think must weigh 20 pounds altogether. It's huge. Incredibly detailed cases of, people with birthmarks. For example, I'm just thinking of one right now where the child was talking about the life of somebody that was killed with a shotgun prior to this, and the kid had like a shrapnel patterned birthmark on his chest where that shotgun wound would have been in the dead person, and he was able to match it up with autopsy records and even photographs from the morgue.
Yeah, and I've got the book where reincarnation and biology intersect. That's kind of taken
right
from his 2-volume thing, isn't it?
Right. That's the sort of abbreviated version, which he said was, I think, brutally edited down to what you have there. Yes. So he thought this was, somehow evidence that the emotional residue that affected the bodily form of the child had transferred over the reincarnation cycle.
He did get documents, didn't he? Was it autopsy reports and things from the previous life? And he was able to match up the wounds on the previous body with the birthmarks on the child.
That's correct, yeah. So it was, in the best cases, it was both the memories of the child that could be confirmed, but also these physical anomalies that could be matched to actual medical documentation from the life of the previous personality. And this was related to his earlier research. I said that he was involved with psychosomatic medicine. And before he even began delving into parapsychology, that was his claim to fame. He was basically doing research on how, in this life, intense emotional states impact bodily form and expression. So, for example, if you're giving a public talk and, you know, some people have a lot of anxiety about a public talk and they've got blotches that are popping, you know, coming up on their neck or something like that, or even just thinking about a distressing life event, you know, such as a philandering partner or a delinquent child, something like that could make your heart race. Basically, he was studying how these intense, oftentimes negative emotional states impacted bodily form. And with reincarnation, he thought that it's related somehow, because basically it's, you know, affecting not this body here, but embryological development in another body.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife. And I hope you check it out. Did he have a theory as to why this might happen?
He did. I don't know how well developed the theory was. I mean, for most of his cases, he was preoccupied with documenting that it happened rather than trying to explain how it happened. He thought that the theory should follow from the data or the evidence. He did have a sort of a cursory theoretical framework involving what he called the psychosphere, which is the idea that there must be some physical form, some substrate that holds memories, including these intense emotional states that affect embryological development, that departs from the body after death and somehow implants in another body. We just simply don't understand or can't conceptualize or can't measure what that physical substrate is, but he referred to it as the psychosphere.
Well, could we get into one of the cases in your book? There's William George Sr., who was returning as his own grandson.
Right. This was one of his earliest cases, and I think this was a case that was complicated, and it reveals potential issues and biases with his research, because the case involved not remembering the life of a completely unrelated stranger, but somebody within the family. So this was what he called an intrafamilial reincarnation case. And those were problematic because it's hard to rule out a child just simply coming to gather or acquire information through normal means over dinner conversation or looking at family photos or overhearing gossip. And, you know, the adults or the parents, whatever, basically underestimating the what the child is learning. But he nevertheless thought it was aside from that issue, he thought it was an interesting case. This was a fisherman in Alaska that basically was having a conversation with his son and said that if I die, I want you to remember this particular scar on my body. I can't remember exactly where it was. I think it was on his arm. And I'm going to come back as your child, and this will be the mark of my return. And also, here's a watch. Here's my favorite watch. I want you to keep this. I want you to have this for safekeeping after I die. And then shortly after that, he drowns on the boat, this grandfather. And 9 months later, there was the baby that was born to the son's wife, and had the scar where the grandfather predicted that it would occur on the exact same place, and had a peculiar interest, I guess, in that family heirloom, the watch that the grandfather had left. And there were other things too, like he had a limp. The child had a sort of born with a limp that matched an old injury that the grandfather had. He had similar personality characteristics as the grandfather. He referred to his great aunt as his sister, you know, things like that, that suggested that it was some version of the grandfather reborn in this child.
Okay, so it wasn't just like talking about his grandfather and saying it, well, that was me. It was also the birthmarks and the limps, so that helps it a bit, I suppose.
Right, it was the sort of constellation of traits that convinced Ian Stevenson that this was a compelling case. Even though, again, he couldn't separate out the possibility that, well, maybe the kid just heard about the grandfather through word of mouth, through overhearing conversations, looking at photos and that sort of thing. So again, this is where, you know, Ian Stevenson couldn't say this is proof of reincarnation. It's just all considered, it's suggestive of reincarnation.
So was his research affecting his reputation?
I think so. I mean, he was very much concerned about that. And it was evident in writing this book, looking, you know, reading his private letters and talking to his relatives and even former colleagues, that he was very careful in sort of navigating his academic reputation as a respected psychiatrist and serious scientist with these more, I guess, evocative, what many would consider to be fringe cases of investigation. And he was able to maintain that balance successfully throughout his career. But I think one of the things that bothered him the most was that he was never really taken seriously by those that he wanted to convince the most, which were really materialistic scientists that would look at the evidence, engage with his findings, and have a conversation with him. They basically just ignored him. So he had lots of followers, and he still does, but they were mostly people who were already convinced that reincarnation is real.
And it wasn't just the reincarnation he was interested in, was it? Because he had an interest in near-death experiences and worked with Dr. Bruce Grayson on this.
He did. Some of Bruce Grayson's earliest research, I believe, was with Ian Stevenson in that area, in near-death experiences. And, you know, I guess summarizing his position on near-death experiences, at least at that time, which was sort of the 1980s that he was writing about this, he had a very cautious, you know, mostly skeptical approach to near-death experiences as providing substantive evidence of the afterlife. He had every conviction that these people believed that they had near-death experiences and that these were meaningful experiences for them. But in terms of providing solid evidence, I guess, for discarnate bodies or the afterlife, he wasn't entirely convinced.
And did he look at the verified ones, the veridical experiences?
What was available, I guess, as documented in the literature at that time. But he didn't find a perfect case.
And he wrote a book called, is it Telepathic Impressions? What was he doing with that book?
Right. Right. So, you know, most people identify him with his primary area of research, which was children's memories of previous lives. But he was fascinated by all topics in parapsychology, including telepathy. So this book, Telepathic Impressions, is basically these detailed case studies of people coming to have information that otherwise they simply shouldn't have. So just to give you one example in the book, you know, a mother was in the kitchen making tea, and she suddenly felt this scalding sensation on her hand and dropped the tea kettle. And it happened at exactly the same time that her daughter was burned in a chemical accident at school. Or, you know, learning about a deceased loved one and having an image of them in terms of what was happening to them, and then ultimately getting confirmation of that only later. So, you know, pretty convincing case studies, I suppose, of telepathic experiences, usually involving the afterlife of some sort still.
And I suppose researching all these other things, not just children's past life memories, must have really helped inform him on this whole area.
Right. He was, you know, he was a very literate scholar, I think, in parapsychology, generally speaking, not just reincarnation. He also looked at apparitions. You know, there were lots of cases that he went into detailed reports of sightings of apparitions and tried to authenticate witness reports and that sort of thing.
And there's a quote I picked out of the book. I think this is later on in the research. Chester, I was going to say, emailed him, sent him a letter and said, I've had some disturbing thoughts about reincarnation based on the world population growth. So did they discuss that? What did they come up with?
Yeah, I think the original concern, and this is something that you hear often even now in terms of criticisms of reincarnation and the plausibility of that happening, is that they're just simply weren't, you know, where do all these souls come from, basically, if the population has expanded so rapidly over the past 200-300 years, what is the sort of fodder, spiritual fodder, for these new materialized forms? And ultimately, they realized that while there were, you know, I can't remember the exact figure, I think it was like 80 to 90 million people that lived over the course of history, of human history, since the species evolution. And that allows for at least 20 incarnations for each person who ever lived. And that's considering even that everybody is reincarnated, or there's the equal interval of time between lives. So it wasn't as much of a non-starter, I guess, as they thought it could be originally, once they actually looked at the numbers carefully.
So I wanted to ask about another case in the book. It was Owen Howison and the Blue Orchid. Could you tell us what happened with that one?
Well, that was one of the cases of apparitions that Ian Stevenson investigated, and I'm not entirely sure how he came to be aware of this. It was probably a letter that he received from somebody in the public that basically said he had a very puzzling experience that could be demonstrable, verifiable evidence of a conscious personality in the afterlife. And basically what happened is that there was this happened in Cape Town, South Africa. And there was a young man, 18, 19 years of age, who was living with his family. He was from the UK, but they had recently moved to South Africa and went for a hike up Table Mountain, the famous Table Mountain, where there are this incredible plethora of wildflowers, including roses, and they're all fiercely protected by the local government because these are endangered plants, basically, so you can't take them with you. But this boy was so enraptured by this particular blue flower that he decided to take one and give it to his mother at home. So he tucked it into his shirt, went home, and was about to give it to his mother, pulling it out of his shirt, and somebody knocked on the door, and he thought it could be the police coming to get him to arrest him for, you know, being caught with this this flower. So he put it back into his shirt, and it was just his sister. And they brought it back out again to give it to his mother, and his brother knocked on the door, so he put it back into his shirt. And of course, that was a false alarm too. Anyway, eventually he gave it to his mother, and everybody laughed about it. And she put it in the house, and it had a very intense fragrance, she said, that smelled for about a week or so. Anyway, fast forward a couple of months, and he's in World War One, I believe, and he's killed in a tank on a mission, killed instantly in the town, in somewhere in France. And his cousin, who still lived in the UK, said not long after that, she had a experience where she saw his apparition in her living room, Owen's apparition in her living room, and she saw his wounds, and she couldn't really talk to him, but she said that he made this strange demonstration by pulling out a blue flower from his shirt and then putting it back in his shirt and pulling it out again. And she had no idea what that gesture meant. And it was only in further conversation with Owen's mother that she got to the bottom of that, that's actually what happened. That scene happened in real life before he died. And this was his way of communicating that he was actually there and trying to provide, you know, some comfort to his surviving relatives. And Ian kind of threw himself into the case and teased apart all these letters over the years, and what the aunt said to the mother and what the mother said to her sister, and trying to sort of untangle these intricate networks of information about the sensational story about Owen's apparition. And it's a little muddy, I have to say, but Ian thought that there was something convincing that actually did happen. To make a long story short.
Now, I wanted to talk to you about Dolores and Gretchen Gottlieb, but first of all, there's a sentence in your book where you say the fad of past life hypnotic regression was especially irksome to Ian. So what was his view on it?
He did not trust past life regression therapy because he thought that it was too vulnerable to confabulation and inserting ideas and just sort of dreamlike imagery that felt like a narrative, was dramatic, but ultimately was pulled from whatever perceptual content the person had experienced in real life in formulating a story of a previous existence. And I guess, you know, what contributed to that was, you know, maybe his experiences with the Bridie Murphy case and that kind of unraveling, or at least being deeply questionable. And he ultimately just simply didn't think that that's where we're likely to find the most convincing objective evidence of previous lives or an afterlife for that matter, because people's susceptibility to imagination.
I think the good thing about him was that he did research it. He didn't just have that opinion and pay no more interest. So could you tell us about the Dolores and Gretchen Gottlieb?
So this was a case of hypnotic regression, and he thought that it had particular currency or sort of empirical currency because it was, it offered some unique aspects that provided, I guess, what he considered more objective scientific evidence. And that was the fact that this woman who was hypnotized, basically began speaking in a language that was previously unknown to her. So it was a middle-aged woman who was living in Ohio at the time. She was a pastor's wife, not terribly well-educated, hadn't traveled to Europe ever. And her husband, who was kind of a lay hypnotist, I guess this was a fad at the time, put her put her under hypnosis to alleviate a back pain. And she was on the couch and he asked her how she was, if she was still experiencing pain or if she still hurt. And she said nein in German, and then proceeded to speak in German. And the husband had absolutely no idea what she was saying, but because he didn't know German. And ultimately, Ian Stevenson discovered this case and began a 3-year investigation of this woman. Using as stringent criteria as he could to find out whether she was somehow speaking a language that maybe she did learn somehow. I mean, this was before the internet, of course, so she wasn't learning by the Rosetta Stone, like some sort of app on her iPhone. There was no logical explanation for how she knew German. But what he thought was especially convincing was that not only was she using German phrases and saying German expressions, but she also responded to questions that were posed to her in German. So he called this responsive xenoglossy, speaking a foreign language, but also being able to hold a sensible or at least intelligible dialogue in a language that was unknown. And it was only under hypnosis that she was able to do this.
Did the researchers feel it was genuine, or that she was just reciting, say, something she'd heard somewhere, and it wasn't that she really understood what she was saying?
Well, Ian Stevenson, he went to great lengths to eliminate any possibility that she actually did learn, she had learned German in her normal waking life somehow. He actually went to her childhood home, interviewed her parents, relatives, neighbors, former teachers, looked at her textbooks in high school. I mean, this was during, she went to high school during World War II, during the Hitler era. So no high schools at that time in the U.S. were even teaching German. There were no German families that lived anywhere that she'd ever lived. And she said the only exposure she had to German in her waking life was, you know, Hogan's Heroes, this terrible TV series in the 1960s, where, you know, there were these bursts of German expletives, but not what she was saying during these hypnosis sessions, which were oftentimes filled with archaic language, things that Germans said in the 19th century, basically not what they say today. So she also took a lie detector test. He flew her to New York City and had her undergo a polygraph test at that time, which she passed. So he said he was able to eliminate fraud conclusively, essentially, in the case. And also the possibility that it was cryptomnesia, that somehow she'd learned German but wasn't consciously aware of learning German. He said that he was able to do that as well. So it was a genuine mystery. He brought in linguistic experts from Germany that also analyzed her dialect and her expressions and tried to place her accent, you know, those types of things. And all of them basically concluded that she was saying things that she couldn't, that this Dolores woman, the housewife, wouldn't have possibly known. But it was not very sophisticated German. It was quite halting, oftentimes just, you know, a couple of word responses. And, you know, this was not like an eloquent conversation that you were having with somebody in German. It was quite stifled in terms of her dialogue.
And she talked about family, didn't she? Did she say her father was the mayor of Eberswalde or something, but they couldn't trace the family?
Right. So she gave enough information that while under hypnosis to try to identify whether an actual teenage girl named Gretchen, who this woman said that she was under hypnosis and spoke in German, they could actually find her in historical archives in this town in Eberswalde, Germany, not too far from Berlin, if she had actually existed. So she talked about her, she gave her father's name. She talked about what he did for a living, that he was a, the mayor of the city. She talked about street names and shops in this city. And she gave the names of the housekeeper and her children, you know, details like that. And when Ian Stevenson and his colleagues actually went to Ebersfold to look at the historical records, they could find nobody matching the characteristics or the information that the woman gave that would prove that she ever existed. But typical of Ian Stevenson, he said, well, that's, you know, maybe it's, she's using this character of Gretchen as a narrative vehicle for somebody who actually did learn German or did know German in a previous life. And this is part of Dolores's attempts to make sense of the information that she's getting. And let's not forget, he said, that the most important thing from a paranormal perspective is the fact that she was speaking German and also answering questions in German. And that's not something that she could have possibly have learned in her normal life.
Yeah, because there are cases of people who have injuries, I think, head injuries or something, and they wake up in hospital and they speak with a foreign accent.
Foreign accent syndrome.
Yeah, and there was a guy I read about in Australia that when he woke up, he could speak Mandarin, I think it was, and that he'd only had a tiny amount of teaching in that at school.
Right.
I mean, I walked away from the case kind of mind boggled and confused and, you know, typical of a lot of Ian's cases, which are very complicated. Once you really sort of look at the details, they're not clear cut in one direction or the other.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called The Incredible Afterlives of Dr. Stevenson, and people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, anywhere books are sold.
Fantastic. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
I really appreciate it. It's been nice chatting with you, Simon.
This week, I was talking to Jesse Baring about his book, The Incredible Afterlives of Dr. Stevenson. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And a great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you'll get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.